Welcome to the Foolish Racing Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:57 PM, that is Central Time. Today is Friday, and it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes on September 24th. So China Evergrande has been making headlines all week, and not before time, because this has been a crisis that's been brewing now for months. And arguably it started with the bankruptcy of Huarong, and that was earlier on this year. So there's been a lot of historical comparisons, whether this is like the long-term capital management problem, whether it was more like the Lehman moment for China. But perhaps it's more like, sometimes they say that the bell doesn't ring at the top of a bull market, but maybe this is the bell ringing for the top of the Chinese property market. And of course, property markets aren't exchange traded, so they're more difficult to monitor. We can obviously look at the fate of some of the big property developers, and we can also realize that Evergrande peaked in 2017, so this has been a long, slow grind lower. But it exposes some of the big problems that exist within the Chinese system. And by far the most pressing and the most difficult to deal with is the fact that the local governments in China do not get enough of money to fund their operations from the central government, and they rely on land sales to pad out their finances. And this has been an ongoing point of stress between local governments and the central government for as long as the Republic has been in place. So how is it then that they go and fund themselves? Well, they go off and they sell land, and there's a very cozy relationship between the banks, the property developers, and the government. So ultimately, the property developer raises the money from regular people by selling them a completed property, or, well, in many cases, an incomplete property, or a property that hasn't even begun to be constructed. And then the banks get a share of that, and the central government, or, you know, the municipal government gets a share of that, and everybody's happy. But, of course, it's 100% reliant on continued access to willing sellers and or willing buyers in the property market. And when the property market were to slow down, then obviously that has a knock-on effect for municipals. Now, no one's talking about that yet. What people are talking about is the pass-on effects to the property market and to the other property developers. And we've had meaningful sell-offs. When we think about the bonds that are trading on Evergrande, well, they're trading at 25 or 30 cents on the dollar, and even that might be ambitious when we look at what the recovery rates might be in a default situation. And we have plenty of evidence of contagion into the broader property sector, and I think it's relevant that we think about the underperformance that we've seen in the Shanghai property sector and the Hong Kong property sectors, and they don't have China Evergrande as a weighting. So when we look at the constituents, well, just the Shanghai property market is made up more than 65% of the index is three companies that the vast majority of people have never heard of. And what most people are paying attention to are the big weightings within the Hong Kong property sector. It's not as concentrated, but certainly Country Garden Services has been in the news this week, and so has China Resources Land. They popped on the upside on Thursday, gave up some of it in here today. And we can think about the fact that can China afford for the entire property sector to go bust? And the answer, of course, is no, because it would have a catastrophic effect on the ability of the local governments within China to fund themselves. And it's just beyond comprehension that the central government will allow a regional government to default on their debt or to default on their obligations to their citizens. So that suggests that every effort will be made to avoid wider contagion. That doesn't mean that property prices can't come down. It doesn't mean that there won't be future problems in the property developers sector. I think it's actually quite likely that there will be significant problems in the China property developers sector. But are we going to have a waterfall effect in terms of defaults? I think that potential outcome will be avoided at all costs. And what it suggests is that we're at the bottom of the credit cycle in China, and that there will be much more money made available to the wider market. So we're quite likely at the top of the property market, because we're unlikely to ever see growth in property development like we've seen in the past in the future, in China at least. So that's a significant development. Doesn't mean that property development is going to stop. And certainly when we look at the initial signs of what's going to happen with the restructuring of China Evergrande, they're going to ensure that anyone who put down a deposit for a home is going to get that home. So there will still be building, and there's likely to be quite a lot of building. But the free-for-all in terms of building that's been going on for the last 30 or even 40 years, well, that is quite likely at an end. So it means that the commodity demand growth model, which has really taken the commodity worlds by storm over the course of the last 20 years, is going to need a new demand growth driver, because China might still have the demand, but is it going to have the demand growth that would be used to then be the rationale for expanding supply of all manner of different commodities? And the answer to that is probably unlikely. Now, obviously, it's well within the capability of the Communist Party to intercede and to ensure that growth persists for a while longer. And certainly with the turning of the credit cycle and more money being available, then there will be at least some speculative activity. But the increasing regulation on the market will become a headwind. And ultimately, there's going to have to be a property tax. And that is the end game, because the reliance of local governments on property or in land sales has to be broken. If the back is to be broken in terms of the speculative activity in the property markets and the incentives that local communist officials have to make land sales and to ensure that there are lots of deals going on, well, the only way to circumvent that entire system is to ensure that there is a property tax. But of course, property taxes are extraordinarily unpopular among the wider populace. We can think about the poll tax in the UK. And I remember friends of mine were on a school tour to London during the poll tax riots, and they really were surprised at how vigorous they were. But the reality is that China is one of the least taxed countries in the world, and tax avoidance schemes are rampant. And the only people that eventually end up paying taxes are in those companies that are heavily regulated and are audited by financial officials, whereas anyone who's self-employed or within smaller companies where your income can be underreported so that you can then pay less taxes on it and take home more, and then the your employer doesn't have to pay nearly as much social insurance either, so it's a very happy set of circumstances. These kinds of conditions prevail throughout the economy, and it means that there is a very small percentage of people end up paying the taxes they in fact owe. So even though China has got a progressive tax system on paper, then it doesn't really have the capability to collect those taxes. And that's a very good reason why they have pioneered the evolution of a digital currency. It's not only because it's a control mechanism, but it's also a taxation mechanism, because when all payments move online, then cashes and cash transactions are a lot easier to hide. So outside of the barter system, if one excises cash from the system, then electronic payments are going to, by and large, be very transparent, and that should help to increase the revenue-raising capabilities from sales taxes, for example. It also will help to ensure that people know, or that the government has visibility on money moving in and out of accounts and where does it come from. So they and the probability of these kinds of intrusive pass-through or seeing into people's personal affairs become progressively more likely, the greater the trouble there's going to be in the property market because of the existential threat that it represents to local government funding mechanisms. When we think about what happened, for example, during the credit crisis in the USA, where it looked really quite likely that companies like AIG and a number of the municipals issuing bonds for anything from schools to airports to roads looked like they were going to go bust. Well, then that's when the big guns were taken out in terms of trying to rescue the economy. And it looks increasingly likely that that is what will happen in China. But ultimately, it's going to point towards lower growth because they have at least seemed to, or at present, it looks increasingly likely that they've reached the conclusion that the speculation in the property market is a threat to national security. And from the perspective of an authoritarian communist regime, what that really means is that it's a threat to the integrity of the rule of a single party. So, power for power's sake, and the only way to ensure that power is held on to is to ensure that no protest movement evolves. And if millions of people become dislocated from their commitment to the China dream and the Chinese ideals, well, from a property market dissolution, obviously that would have, again, existential threats to the Communist Party, and that will be avoided at all costs. So it's increasingly likely that we're going to see significant sums poured into the market, and that there is therefore, obviously, we're not at the peak of bearishness just yet. And the renminbi is still really quite firm. And it has weakened a little over the course of the last few months, but certainly nothing in a dynamic manner. Just a loss of momentum, I think, would be the only justifiable description of what we have right now. But if we get a dynamic move through the 200-day moving average, well, then that will be representative of significant issuance and probably more massive additional supply of currency. And it is looking increasingly likely that the big guns will have to be taken out to ensure that this does not turn into a debacle. So we're at an interesting juncture here, and it's a good reason why stock markets remain reasonably well bid, and particularly outside of China. Well, the polar opposite is occurring in India. India's credit markets bottomed in, let's see if we can find, like, for example, if we think about D1, Housing Finance, and the share peaked in 2018, it's coming down now for 3 years. Now, one of the particular reasons why it declined, and of course it was suspended in June, so this is one of the failures that have occurred within the housing market. But one of the big reasons why it pulled back was because they basically banned the company from using deposits for working capital. And This had a significant knock-on effect for lots of the property development companies. And those that couldn't survive without using the deposits on yet-to-be-built projects for working capital have gone bust. So that's a significant development in India. But it's washed through already. So now we're starting to see a new property cycle. And the affordability ratio of property to incomes has improved considerably. And we're starting to see significant investment in steel production. So, steel production is obviously something that's not really associated with India. Now, Tata Steel has surged higher over the course of the last year, and it has certainly pulled back in line with the big decline we've had in iron ore prices over the course of this month. And now it's in the region of the upper side of the underlying range. So let's set aside for a moment the correction that's going on right now and think about why would people be so eager to support steel shares in India? Well, it's primarily about infrastructure development. And the last big commodity-led bull market coming up off the lows in 2000 was about Chinese demand and the fact that they were building a new Manhattan every couple of months, and that it was a massive outsized growth issue, and there was an inability of miners to keep up with that demand, and then a reluctance to increase supply because they wanted to help support prices. And it turned into a significant demand growth story, and it was led higher by oil and by iron ore. And it was all about infrastructure development in China. Well, today we're at a similar situation in India because we're at the point of where there are millions of young people that are coming into the workforce for the first time. They have, as young people everywhere, they have the same ideals. They want to have a better life than their parents had. They want to achieve a middle-class lifestyle, and they're willing to work and to do whatever is necessary to achieve that. And if whatever government is in place at the time doesn't do what's necessary, they'll keep voting for new governments until they get what they want, which is clear economic development parameters. And it does look increasingly likely that that is what India is beginning to put in place. So now everyone in or every family in the country already has a bank account, and there is a biometric data has been taken for everyone, so that for the illiterate, then there is the clear ability to have a unique identity. So this is also a significant development, and the banking sector continues to recover, and the housing prices are starting to recover, and then we're getting increasing revenue and the ability to enhance funding for steel. So it's increasingly likely that India is going to become a manufacturing powerhouse. And one thing I've already noticed is that when I look at, well, I'm dragged along shopping with my wife and my daughters. I just simply spend my time looking at where things are manufactured. And the number of things manufactured in India has increased substantially. So we're already seeing manufacturing moving there, and that trend is likely to increase. And most particularly, it's going to increase by Chinese factories migrating to India because they have young people and China doesn't. So, on the one hand, it suggests that certainly there are going to be big Chinese companies benefit from this migration, and those that migrate first will benefit most. It also suggests that India is today where China was perhaps 20 years ago in terms of its manufacturing capability and infrastructure development. And India also has the tailwinds of a geopolitical imperative that everyone wants to see India succeed because they need India to act as a counterbalance to China's power in the region. So everything seems to be lining up for India to outperform in a big way over the medium term. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not an extremely volatile market. And there are occasions when India is quite capable of pulling back by 20 and 30%. And in a secular bull market, those are universally buying opportunities. And then we can think about some of the funds that are doing reasonably well. The Aberdeen New Dawn Investment Trust continues to trend higher. And what I found interesting today is looking at its NAV, even over the course of the last 10 years, the discount is still below the average levels overall. So it has historically traded at a discount, but even then, the average value has generally been tighter than it is right now. So there's not a lot of enthusiasm for emerging markets right now. But when we think about what the outlook is overall, well, the ex-China ETF has not been immune from selling pressure in the emerging markets, but it hasn't broken downwards either. And it's continuing to firm here in the region of the trend mean. So there are obviously two ways of looking at this eventuality in the emerging markets. It looks increasingly likely that Chinese growth will slow down and that the growth potential of the economy will moderate. And that's normal considering the size of the economy. But the debt ratios and the internal challenges that the economy has, well, that's likely to result in even slower growth than had initially perhaps been anticipated. Whereas there is ample scope for India to pick up the baton in terms of global economic growth of a major population center. Obviously, there are going to be other countries in Asia that also do very well. Vietnam is already a manufacturing powerhouse, but it doesn't have, I mean, the number of people that are under the age of 20 in India is multiples of the total population of Vietnam. So when we think about the potential for massive growth in the middle class and consumption and earning potential and productive capacity and the realistic potential that eventually India will have a currency that isn't perpetually weak, then that's all in the future. So there is obviously the potential that it's India will be the demand growth driver to pick up the baton from China's moderating growth. Then, of course, there's the additional potential that we're in a completely new secular bull market, which will be led by commodity demand growth from new sectors. And most particularly, that's likely to be led by copper. So copper got all the way back down to the $4 level in here today, this week, and rebounded. Now, it still has the sequence of lower rally highs, and it might be a while yet before it can break that sequence and push above the 450 area. But this hasn't really looked like anything more than a consolidation in the region of the all-time peak, and it's been an awfully lengthy range. And I think this is also particularly relevant that when we look at the log scale charts, well, we get these profoundly lengthy ranges. Unfortunately, we don't have the same kind of back history for copper prices that we do, for example, for gold. But we had a very long range that proceeded all the way through the 1990s. Then we had the big breakout, and subsequently the prices came back to test the upper side of the range, and now we're pushing on the upside again. So big bull markets in commodities are followed by ranges that last more than a decade. And arguably the big advance that we had in copper ended in about 2007. We had a brief flurry to new highs in 2011 that were not sustained. And now we're back in that area again. Of course, there's going to be this massive debate, particularly in places like the UK and Europe right now, about exactly what should be done about renewable energy and base load electricity. Because the massive surge in natural gas prices and has obviously had significant knock-on effects, and the fact that the wind stopped blowing for a prolonged period has obviously also been a very significant factor. And of course, natural gas prices have also been ranging for what feels like a profoundly long time. So the peak was back in 2005, and subsequently, prices just went sideways. So now we've had a significant breakout and pretty much a doubling in the price. I would hazard a guess that we're not that far away from a peak. We've had a phenomenal acceleration, and the wind will start blowing eventually. And the massive increase in prices in Europe will encourage new supply into the market, whether that is from Norway increasing its supply, whether it's eventually because the Nord Stream 2 pipeline gets permissioned by Germany and Russia starts sending more supply into Europe, or whether it's because of increasing supply from other sources or the fall off in demand, ultimately the price will start to come back down. And we've certainly seen a significant loss of momentum over the course of the last 10 sessions. So the peak has not been confirmed, and we might even see an additional pop on the upside in here. But ultimately, I think the more important point is that we're likely to have a higher reaction low when the peak does come in. And it's quite likely that the new low for natural gas prices will be closer to 100, and that we're unlikely to ever go back to the lows that had been put in over the course of the last few years. So we're in a new price structure, and we're putting in new floors for these following these extremely impressive breakouts. Now, of course, there's two ways to think about this. One would be to think, well, this foray into renewable energy has been a complete waste of time, and it has done nothing to improve standards of living, and in fact, it's making them worse. So it should be abandoned, and we should just go back to the way things were. And that's not a particularly popular way of thinking. I think it's more likely that politicians and the green movement are going to double down and say that this is a necessary sacrifice, and which is required in order to achieve the long-term goals of decarbonization, and that we need to, in fact, spend more money on renewable energy, and that ultimately we are going to have baseload electricity provision, and that it will be generated from hydrogen. So that is a potential outcome, and then there's the potential that the baseload electricity could be generated by uranium. So we've certainly seen a big pop on the upside in uranium, and the price is coming back down a bit now, and it's unwinding the short-term overbought condition. Ultimately, it's going to have to find support in the region of the trend mean if the bull market hypothesis is going to be vindicated. The challenge is that the supply surplus that resulted in the big bear market, well, whether Kazatom decides that they're going to curtail supply or not is really the linchpin in terms of the new secular bull market hypothesis. And ultimately, the price has to find support around the $20 area if we're to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. But if we're going to double down as a planet on the need for renewable energy, then we absolutely have to come up with base load solutions. So the three base load solutions are that are carbon free. Well, one of them would be to invest in more nuclear energy, or to at least ensure that the nuclear power plants we have remain operational. The second would be to invest in batteries, and that would mean big stationary batteries, particularly aluminium or zinc-based batteries, would benefit there, and that would also contribute to commodity price inflation. And the London Metals Index continues to steady in the region of its all-time peaks. So this looks eerily similar to what we've had in copper. We can then just simply look at this in terms of aluminium prices as well. And this has also been a phenomenal run on the upside. And the prices for aluminium got up to the 1998 peak during the big bull market in 2007, and we're back there now. So this is a 30-year range where there is this very incremental sequence of higher reaction lows, and we're now right in the region of the 3000 level. So there's also the potential that we're going to see additional upside here. Now, obviously, when we think about what the challenges are in China, there are risks here that I think a situation in China that doesn't go according to plan could have a big knock-on effect for commodity prices. We don't have any evidence that that's indeed the case today. In fact, if anything, we see that commodity prices are continuing to do well because investors are willing to look through the problems to what the solutions are. And I think this has been a factor that has contributed to asset price appreciation over most of the last 2 years, because it started off with the pandemic. So obviously, we did have a big pullback in early 2020, because people were worried about the pandemic and they didn't know much about it. But because the problem was so large and the answer to that problem was so profound, then we had significant asset price appreciation. And anyone who was willing to look through the problem to what the impact of the solution would be, well, they were very richly rewarded. And we've had these phenomenal bull markets come through on Wall Street. So the S&P 500 quickly rebounded to a new all-time peak, and then from 3,200 it went to 4,500 in the space of another year. So we've had a very significant bull market, and arguably it's still intact. Now we've had a somewhat larger pullback in here this week. So it's not as consistent as it was, but the sequence of higher major reaction lows is still intact, and it's only partially unwound its overbought condition relative to the trend mean. So it would be really hard to argue that this trend isn't still very much intact. When we think about that willingness to look through problems, well, we're definitely seeing that in China right now, that investors are willing to look through the problem. They can see everything that's gone wrong with the Evergrande question. They can even look at what happened in India when some of those property investors went bust, but they can also look at what happened in India, that it didn't really affect the economy very much, and subsequently it has done much better. And they can look at what China is capable of in terms of stimulus. So they're looking through the problem and coming up with the conclusion that there's going to be a massive liquidity infusion. So there's no need to sell. In fact, there is a rationale for buying because this is just another one of these buy-the-dip scenarios. And there's a good rationale there that China simply cannot allow the risk, and it's a significant risk of contagion. And therefore, they will have to act and do so in a very profound manner in order to achieve their goals. And of course, the other thing that's we've learned from various crises in the past, it's that once a government and central bank decide that they are going to intervene, well, then they have to continue to intervene until they reach their goal. So we're not quite there with China yet, but it's extremely likely that they are going to have to intervene. And I think at present what they're trying to do is to find out who owns those US dollar bonds and how easy it will be to burn them. And once they figure that out, then we're going to see a much clearer picture of what their plans in fact are. But right now, the biggest challenge that is presented by markets is that central banks are becoming progressively more hawkish. And 10-year treasury yields were up in a dynamic manner this week. So we had a 12 basis point move yesterday and up another couple in here today, and clearly breaking up and out of this little range. So this now is bringing the question of debt servicing costs back front and center. I wrote quite a bit about this as yields trended through 1% and all the way up to the peak back in February, March, because servicing the debt is much more difficult today than it was 2 years ago. When yields were 3%, then there was a lot of concern that yields were popping through 3%, that we were in a new inflationary cycle, and that the debt problems were going to be significant. Well, since then, the debt has multiplied, and the servicing cost of that debt, in fact, declined in 2020. Well, those servicing costs are going to start rising again. But it's going to be a particular problem for the USA because the duration of the debt is that much shorter. So the 5-year is the most appropriate duration to pay attention to. And it looks increasingly likely that it is going to pop through the 1% level. So the USA has got a significant bulge of maturities around the 5% level, or excuse me, around the 5-year level. Other countries have got much longer durations on their debt. So the UK is 14 years. Australia is like 8 years. Germany is only about 6 or 7 years. But the USA is 5 years. So obviously this is something that needs to be paid attention to. Well, what investors are doing is that they're looking through it again. And they're saying, well, this problem with debt servicing costs and the knock-on effect that that's going to have on the ability of governments to fund themselves and the necessity that would be implied that services would have to be cut and additionally taxes would have to be raised in order to fund the government. Well, that's just untenable, that the populations are already on unhappy following the pandemic. And then of course we've had the rise in populism, and the last time we had inflationary pressures rising was in 2010 and 11, and China's stimulus ran out and they tried to normalize, and then the Tea Party took control the balance of power in the US Congress and pushed through their austerity regime. So that robbed inflation of its impetus. But there's no appetite for that kind of fiscal austerity now. When we think about the significant public protests we had last year and the clear incentive to simply print your way out of trouble, and they haven't seen any evidence of trouble from printing money so far, so there is still a clear intention to spend their way out of trouble. And markets are looking through the threat from central banks and thinking, well, central banks can't raise rates aggressively. And if they start to taper aggressively, then it's going to have a knock-on effect on the economy. And that's going to undo all the good work that they did during the pandemic. So they're going to have to be extraordinarily cautious. And that only supports the view that we're still going to have a bull market because we're going to have ample liquidity. We're going to have central banks that have been cowed by the threat of public unrest. So this is obviously still a very benign environment. And that's an argument that's hard to argue with. So what we're definitely seeing is plenty of examples of where investors are willing to look through potential problems to the inevitable solutions and then just avoid selling because they don't believe that they are going to profit from selling and buying and selling and buying. And of course, what this also means is that the buy the dip strategy is still working and that all the traders who have habitually been buyers and sellers are now just holders. And the evolution of the just hold it strategy, well, that's representative of the third psychological perception stage of the bull market, because we can see where the problems are going to be. And eventually bond yields are going to rise enough that they really do eat into growth potential. And they really do represent a threat to the integrity of the bull markets. And most particularly that they represent a threat to the interest rate sensitive portion of the market. And that's particularly represented by growth. But arguably, we're just not there yet. And historically, the beginning of a new hiking cycle has generally been viewed as positive by investors because it's a vote of confidence by central banks in the continued stability and potential for growth in the economy. Eventually, though, the more that yields rise, then the greater the headwind they represent to growth, and eventually they represent such a tall headwind that it turns over into a recession. So when we then think about the yield curve spread, historically, the big pushes above the 150 basis point level have corresponded with significant pullbacks. And right now we're at 118 basis points, and the spread has increased this week, and not least because of that pop on the upside in terms of the 10-year yield. If this is still a very inert environment, ultimately, it's when the short end of the curve rises faster than the long end of the curve that liquidity starts to get choked off. So as long as the yield curve spread is rising, then that liquidity is not getting choked off. And I do think it's likely that we're not going to get to the highs that are anticipated by the Federal Reserve. They think that they're going to get to an interest rate of 1.6% by 2024. And maybe they do. Maybe the stock market continues to rally. Maybe the problems are moderated enough, and then we go into a really incredibly powerful acceleration phase and bubbly environment, and interest rates eventually peak at 1.6%. So there's the potential that inflation does pick up and that we continue to run a negative real interest rate environment. And I do think that that is a likely scenario, that we're going to be in a negative real interest rate environment for the foreseeable future. And when we then think about what's happening in terms of gold, Well, if inflationary pressures are rising and governments are going to spend more and more, why isn't gold doing better? Well, I think a good part of the reason is because of the difficulties that are currently happening in places like China and then India because of the pandemic, that they cut off demand for physical gold. And then we have the fact that negative real interest rates are indeed negative, or real interest rates are indeed negative, but that the bigger issue is that the how negative they are has been moderating. So we had a very significant downtrend in real interest rates until about August of 2020, and since then we haven't really seen very much of anything. So now the negative real interest rate is starting to trend back upwards. I really don't think we're going anywhere near zero, but as long as that is rising, it represents a headwind for gold prices overall. So I think that's one of the factors that's contributing to this underperformance from gold. But nonetheless, I still think it's more likely than not that the $1,700 area is going to hold, and that ultimately gold will start to do better, and not least because of these factors, that we are in more of an inflationary environment, and in many respects, governments and central banks are hamstrung in terms of what they can do to curtail inflationary pressures. So we may see some modest tapering and quantitative tightening going on at the Federal Reserve, but that it will not keep pace with the inflationary pressures overall. So the supply bottlenecks that we continue to see as a result of the pandemic, they might last a while longer. They might last all the way through until 2022, and that wouldn't be all that surprising. The big inflationary move off the lows in 2009 lasted for 2 years as well. It's what happens after that is going to be the big question from a long-term perspective, because ultimately it's within the hands of governments and central banks to decide whether they are going to tackle the debt issues in a responsible manner or whether they're going to renege on that responsibility. And they've already tried the responsible way. We've got the German election this weekend, and it looks likely at present, at least, that the SPD will win, and that would represent more spending. So even Germany is walking back from its absolute commitment to fiscal austerity. It doesn't mean that Germany is suddenly going to become profligate, but it's not certainly not as austere as it used to be. So everywhere looks like they're going to be increasing liquidity and spending, and even the efforts to try and curtail some of the most egregious excesses are going to run into some political resistance. So generally speaking, that's supportive of a much bigger bull market, and we will have occasional setbacks. But it's not until we have inverted yield curves or really big problems in terms of lack of liquidity that there's the real threat to the wider economy. And we continue to see that technological innovation continues to be brought forward, and the records in terms of solar cells and their absorbance of energy, the records in terms of battery longevity and recharging capacity, they continue to be broken. And the evolution of the biotech sector, the fact that Moderna is now in clinical trials for a mosquito, sorry, a malaria vaccine. These are significant innovations that the big proof of concept for mRNA technology was the pandemic. and it's been proven to be safe. And now there is limitless potential for genetic solutions to intransigent problems. And malaria is one of the biggest in the world. So if malaria gets solved, then that removes a massive headwind to growth from Africa. And if we think about after India, where is the place with the most young people, and where is the demographic bonus going to come from? Well, Africa and a significant number of countries within the continent are likely to do well from that evolution. And technological innovation benefits everyone, and the ubiquitousness of access that's evolved with globalization also is creating geopolitical tensions with places like China, but ultimately it helps to boost productivity, and productivity boosts create bull markets in asset prices. So we're certainly in an environment where there are challenges, and there's a willingness by investors to look through them, and that's indicative of the third psychological perception stage of the bull market. It's not until central banks act in a significant manner to curtail liquidity that we would have to worry about a peak. And we're only at the beginning of the interest rate hiking cycle, and the problems really start to erupt towards the end. So we're at the point now where there is this clear potential for bubbly valuations. And certainly with the potential for massive investment in renewable energy, and particularly with geopolitical imperatives to become energy independent, then that's certainly a lead candidate, and there's likely to be an awful lot of interest in emerging markets as they start to pick up some of the slack left by China's growth and as they mobilize their populations to become the manufacturing powerhouse of the future. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.